Good morning, church. It is good to see everyone this morning, and good as always to be together, especially when we get to come together and worship and study God's Word and lift up one another in song and gather around this table. Just a great Sunday. And if you are visiting with us, we're really glad you got to be a part of this with us. We are thankful to have you. Any and every opportunity you get the opportunity to be here. I wanted to tell you about one thing that's coming up that we haven't, we're in the works right now, but we've been studying through the Gospel of Mark for the last several years, and it's going to, feels like it, maybe a little, really just this year, but we're going to continue and go finish up the Gospel, and I'm excited about that, and some of you have talked about, have come up and said, you know, that's something I'd never heard about the Gospel of Mark, and that's interesting. How did you learn about this? And so we're putting together a little bit of a study for you to be able to go through on your own. We are joined with Right Now Media, and some of you have already set up your accounts with that, but they have some great, this tremendous video library with some amazing studies that go through different books of the Bible and some additional teaching material on different subjects. If you haven't gotten on there yet, really encourage you to do that. The information on how to do that is in your bulletin. But we're going to be sending out some information shortly about this study through the Gospel of Mark that will be wonderful for you to do. If you do streaming on your TV, it's really easy. You can do it there. You can do it on your laptop. You can do it on your phone. You can do it on your computer. But you just join there and you can follow the study right through as we go along. And there'll be more coming about that soon. I don't know if I've told y'all this before, but years ago when we moved from West Tennessee, we lived in a really small town in West Tennessee, and we had a house there, and we moved to Nashville, and quickly learned as we were in the process of moving to Nashville that we were not going to be able to afford to live in Nashville. And our little house that we had bought for, you know, a little bit and put quite a bit of money and time into it, and we sold it. And so we had a little bit of money from that, but we couldn't buy a house. We moved into the church parsonage in Nashville. So we needed to do something with the money from our old home. So we decided to buy a little rental home, not in Nashville, because, again, we could not afford to buy a house in Nashville. So instead, we bought one in Henderson, Tennessee, where I went to college at Freed Hardeman, and my brother and his wife were nearby, and more importantly, houses were really cheap there. That was the number one priority, and we were able to get a decent home with the money we bought. This is the grandeur that it is. This is a nice little house that we bought. This was on 656 Hill Avenue in Henderson, Tennessee, and so we bought this, and we did a little fixing up, and we turned it into a rental house, and we rented it out to a couple of tenants. Things went well. They'd lived there for a while. Usually it was married students at Freed Hardeman, that was good. And then one particular time, though, it came open, and there was a family just from the community who wanted to move in. And so we looked at their credentials and everything, and the best we could, we said, okay, this will be fine. So they moved in, and things were good for a few months until they weren't. And we started getting reports that, hey, things don't look right there, and there's more people than you would think in that house. And what's with all the cats? Things like that. Then they stopped paying rent, and it was just a whole rigmarole. And I didn't know anything about being a landlord and didn't know what to do. And so we were telling them, okay, look, you're not paying rent. You're not living up to the agreement. And so you need to move out. And they were like, okay. And they didn't move out. And then the next month, the same thing came up. So this goes on. This stretches on for a period of time. And they're not leaving, and so I did something illegal, which I probably shouldn't admit to, but I'm going to do it anyway, because we still had the utilities in our name. So I told them, we're going to cut off the water and electricity. And you can't do that, by the way. That is totally illegal. So don't do that. But I didn't know that at the time. I said, look, I can't afford to keep paying your lights and water, so we're going to cut it off. And I'm coming down there to tell you we're cutting it off. And so finally, when I went down and threatened to cut off the utilities, they moved out. And we were just so thankful they were gone. We didn't care that they took our washer and dryer and that they left everything else they owned, apparently, in the floor. It was just a big, big mess. And that was the last time I decided we needed to own a piece of rental property And when it sounds like a terrible story, it is a terrible story. But when we come to the Gospel of Mark, we get a kind of similar story. We get a story about a landlord and some terrible tenants. One that's similar in that this landlord is also not getting paid. He's not getting what he's owed. And we're going to wonder, what's this landlord going to do? You know, how is he going to make things right? How is he going to fix this situation? Because it can't continue on interminably. This landlord has got to make things right. And you and I, we're going to look at this story, and we're going to see, we're going to totally side with the landlord. And that makes sense because the landlord is right in this instance. But I'm going to try to put us in the shoes of the tenants as well. But it comes from Mark chapter 12. You may remember at the end of chapter 11 together, really the last story from chapter 11, where the chief priests and scribes and Pharisees, they come to Jesus and they ask him, by what authority are you doing these things? Who are you to run the temple, basically, and throw out the money changers and the people are selling things? And who are you to tell people they can't walk through the temple carrying their goods? And Jesus basically challenges their authority. We talked about that last week. Well, this story at the beginning of chapter 12 is a continuation on the same theme with the same audience. It says, then Jesus began to speak to them in parables. Who is the them? It's the chief priests and the scribes and the Pharisees. And remember, the chief priests, scribes, and Pharisees are the Sanhedrin. They're the ruling body under Roman governorship. They're the ruling body that's in charge of all the religious and a lot of times political decisions as well. So Jesus is addressing them. He began speaking to them in parables. He said, a man planted a vineyard. He put a wall around it. He dug a pit for the wine press and built a watchtower. Then he rented the vineyard to some farmers and moved to another place. Now this idea right here, this was pretty common practice at the time. And it happened because, well, you remember in the Old Testament when the Israelites come into the land and God said, all right, everybody gets land. And everybody was like, hooray, even the poor families, everybody gets land. And that was the ideal. That was what it was supposed to be like, where every family have their land. Well, you go through the Israel being carried off into Assyrian captivity, Judah being carried off into Babylonian captivity. Long story short, by the time we get all the way up to Jesus' time, what has happened is that the king, in this case it's Herod, but it's been going on for some time now, the king was charging high tax rates in order to pay off the real leaders, the Romans. He's charging high taxes. There have been droughts. There have been famines. Families get poor. They can't afford to pay their taxes. And so the government seizes their land. And by the time, and that had been going on for quite a bit of time, by the time we get up to this date, basically, the king had all authority. He just took whatever he wanted, and he essentially treated the whole land of Israel as his own. So he gets all this land, and what he would do would say, well, I can't take care of all this land. Who are some really good people? And the wealthy people are like, oh, we're really good people. And the king says, sure, my buddy, the wealthy guy over here, and my buddy, the wealthy guy over there, you be in charge of this 1,000 acres, and you be in charge of that 1,000 acres. He didn't really say 1,000 acres, but you get the idea. He gives out huge allotments of land to really rich people. In the meantime, what about all those poor families who just had their 40 acres and a mule? Well, they become peasant farmers. They are now barely scraping by as sharecroppers on the land that once belonged to their families, right? And so all these upper society, they've got all the land and all the poor people. You get a growing divide between the wealthy and the poor. So which crowd do you think the Sanhedrin was in? The poor peasant farmers or the wealthy people who owned all the land? That's right. They were upper society. They were the land owners. But Jesus does a very clever thing here, one that we might miss, because this is not just any vineyard. This is a very specific vineyard, and based on Jesus' wording, it's very clear that he is referencing the parable of the vineyard in Isaiah chapter 5. You see here, we've got the wall, the wine press, the watchtower. So this is a specific vineyard, we get to Isaiah 5, and we look back there, and this is what Isaiah says: I will sing for the one I love, a song about his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hillside. He dug it up and cleared it of stones with the choicest vines. He built a watchtower and cut out a wine press as well. Then he looked for a crop of good grapes, but it yielded only bad fruit. And he goes on, you find out that he had built this hedge of protection around this wall. The owner of this vineyard in Isaiah does everything possible for this vineyard to produce good fruit. He takes care of it, right? He cares for it. He weeds it. He fertilizes it. He protects it from wild animals with this hedge of protection. He does everything, but he gets no good fruit. So what more can be done? And so in Isaiah, the owner of this vineyard, he gives up on it and destroys the vineyard. He's like, obviously, this land's never going to make anything good. Tear down the watchtower, tear up the wine press, dig up the land, tear down the hedge of protection, let the wild animals run all over it again. And then at the end of Isaiah's parable, we discover something shocking. The vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the nation of Israel, and the people of Judah are the vines he delighted in. This was God's vineyard, and the vineyard were the people, right? So when Jesus starts telling a parable about a vineyard with a watchtower and a wine press and a hedge and a wall, all of his listeners immediately know what he's talking about. He's referencing this parable from Isaiah. And so everybody knows that the vineyard, the land, represents Israel, and that the owner is the Lord. The Lord owns this vineyard, right? But if the vineyard is Israel and the owner is the Lord, who are the tenant farmers? Who are the sharecroppers? Who are those who are entrusted with taking care of the Lord's vineyard? Who's responsible for that? Who are the people making decisions that govern the lives of ordinary Israelites? Well, that's the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders, the ones who make up the Sanhedrin. The leaders of Israel are the tenants. They're the ones who are supposed to look after the nation and make sure it produces the fruit that God is looking for, right? They would love... Now, if you're the Sanhedrin and you're listening to Jesus' parable, you would love nothing more than to be the owner. Because that's your normal role in real life. That is a role that is fitting for you. It's like, you know, if you're casting a play for a play that has wealthy people and poor people, then wealthy kids would be more likely to say, no, I want to be, you know, the rich kid role. I know how to do that. That's who I am, right? I don't want to play a poor peasant because that's beneath me. So the Sanhedrin's listening to Jesus' parable, and they're like, okay, we're going to be the owners. Wait a minute, that's not our vineyard. That's God's vineyard. So God has to be the owner, and Jesus has cast them in the role of peasant farmers, sharecroppers, reminding them of who they were supposed to be in God's economy. They were charged with bringing forth a crop from the land. And Isaiah says that what you're supposed to produce, what the land is supposed to produce, is justice and righteousness. That's the job of the land, is to produce justice for everybody, rich people, poor people, young people, old people, black people, white people, Israelites, aliens. Everybody is supposed to be treated fairly, and righteousness, holiness. So in Jesus' parable, going back to Jesus' parable now, the Lord, who's the owner, right, he goes away to a far land. He steps away for a while, and he entrusts the care of this land to the tenant farmers, the Sanhedrin. And when harvest time comes around, harvest is supposed to be justice and righteousness, he sends a servant to collect the produce. But this time, the peasants revolt. It's exactly like what has happened a few years earlier in Israel. This growing disparity between the wealthy who have taken over large chunks of land and the poor people who are working the land, scraping to get by. They were finally like, this is supposed to be our land. This is our inheritance. This is what God promised to us. And you've taken over and you're not even leaving us enough to live on. So they revolted and Rome came in and crushed it. And then in 70 AD, the same thing is going to happen. the wealthy of Israel, they're getting wealthier and wealthier, and the poor people are getting poorer and poorer. You're ending up with day laborers and beggars and people who are hard working and cannot get enough food to live. And so in 70 AD, they rose up and said, "We can't take this anymore." And that's when Rome came in and crushed it for good, destroyed the temple and all that. So the peasants revolt. The poor people had all lost their land. The government overtaxed them. The landowners now took the lion's share of the crop and the profits. And so they were left to subsist on crumbs and leftovers. The peasants had enough. So the sharecroppers in Jesus' story have had enough. They beat up the owner's servant when he comes to collect the due. They beat up the owner's servant and send him away empty-handed. "It's not fair," they said. "This is our land." And the owner of the land, in this case the Lord, is very patient. So patient. So he sends another servant, which they beat, again, even worse, and send him away. And then they send another servant, which they beat and kill. And then the Lord just keeps sending servants, more servants and more servants. Again and again, the owner sends his servants until they've all been beaten or killed or wiped away. There are no more servants. And knowing that this owner is God gives us a great picture about the character and an insight into who he is, his nature, and his patience and his persistent love. God reached out to Israel time and again and again through his prophets, right? He sent people like Isaiah and Jeremiah and Micah and Habakkuk and Joel and Amos and all these great prophets. He sends them with his word, and they are beaten time and again. Remember when Stephen was stoned in the book of Acts, before he was stoned, he was given this speech. And one of the things he convicted Israel of, he says, "Was there ever a prophet your ancestors did not persecute? Was there ever a prophet your ancestors didn't persecute?" How many times has the Lord shown them mercy time and again? How often has he been patient with them time and again? And it makes me think, how many times has the Lord shown me patience time and again? How long has his persistent love endured despite our rejection of him? In Romans 5, verse 8, the Apostle Paul says, "But God demonstrates his own love for us in this: while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." Wasn't because we were good. Wasn't because we were kind or worthy or righteous or smart or came from good people or we had the right grandparents. It wasn't because we were special in any way, but because of his kindness, because of his mercy, because of his love. That's how we get to this point, because God patiently loves. But now all the servants are gone. So what's the owner to do? He had one left to send, a son whom he loved. He sent him last of all, saying, "They'll respect my son." But the tenants said to one another, "This is the heir. Come, let's kill him and the inheritance will be ours." So they took him and they killed him and they threw him out of the vineyard. The tenants kill the son. And that sounds like just the craziest plan to you and I. This is mayhem. I mean, we cannot imagine if I had, for instance, in my little rental house in Henderson, Tennessee, my brother lived just a mile away. If I'd sent my brother over and said, "Hey, would you go over there and talk to them about this rent? Just go and collect the rent from them. That would be great." And if I'd sent my brother over to my rental house and they'd killed my brother, oh my goodness. Right? Pandelirium. But that's exactly what happens in this parable. The owner sends his son and they kill him. What were they thinking? What kind of plan was this? Well, I'll tell you what kind of plan it was. It was one that almost worked. They're thinking, you know, what if the owner died and this is the last guy with a claim to the land. Well, then, in that case, they had good reason to think their plan would succeed. You see, and under their law, if an owner of a piece of property abandons it for 4 years, if he abandons it for four years, then it goes to the people who are on it, the people who stole it. Or we say it, possession is 9/10 of the law, right? Well, in Jewish law, in practicality, that was how it worked out. If someone didn't claim the land, if it looked abandoned and somebody squatted on it long enough, it became theirs. And so these peasant farmers think we can eliminate the heir, the person who rightfully owns this. If we can eliminate him, it'll just be ours. But unfortunately for these peasant farmers, that was not the case. The owner was very much alive, and he was not about to abandon his beloved vineyard. And so in the minds of Jesus' audience, the scribes and chief priests and Pharisees, and elders, they're thinking, what would I have done if my tenants had done this to my son? Right? That's what's going through their mind. All the property that I own, if I'd sent my son to my property and my tenants had killed him, what would I do? Well, this is what the owner does in Jesus' parable. What then will the owner of the vineyard do? He'll come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. Haven't you read this passage of Scripture? The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. The Lord has done this, and it is marvelous in our eyes. So Jesus' message to Israel's leaders couldn't be any clearer. He is essentially saying, if you were faced with a peasant land revolt, you would crush it and feel justified in doing so. So when you fail to produce the crop God's looking for, justice and righteousness, when you beat his servants and kill his son, why wouldn't God crush you? Why wouldn't God give leadership of his people to someone who he trusts? And when he comes, and he's coming, he's going to take that same son you rejected, and he's going to give, you not only killed him, you didn't even give him a proper burial. And he's going to take that son, and he's going to be the cornerstone for a new temple, for a new people that you have no authority in. It's going to be something brand new, and your position as chief priests, your position as scribes, your position as elders, all of that's going to be washed away, and you're going to be nothing and nobody and gone because of what you did here. And isn't it ironic? These leaders come to Jesus, and they're like, by what authority are you doing these? What gives you the right to say what goes on here in the temple? And now Jesus not only questions their authority like he did last week we talked about it, but he tells them they're about to lose their authority, that their whole house of cards is going to come crumbling down. So it raises the question for us this morning as to what kind of tenants we are. Now, think about this. There's a lot of applications for this particular parable. In one sense, he's saying he's going to give the leadership of God's people to others, like Jesus and his apostles, right? They are leaders of God's people. Or we could think about it, how it applies to leadership here in our congregation. God's going to give leadership of this church. We have the elders who look over us and shepherd us and make wise decisions and aid us in our spiritual growth. Right? God has given them a spiritual leadership role. And so God holds them to a higher standard. But in another sense, no matter who we are in this life, God has placed you in a unique set of circumstances that aren't like mine, in unique positions, in unique places, and he's done that for a reason. We are in homes and workplaces and schools and neighborhoods and organizations. We're in all these different places. We're wealthy or we're scraping by. We're older or we're younger. We're workers or we're students or we're retired. But those circumstances, whatever yours are, Those are like your vineyard. God has given you that little corner of the world. And he comes to us looking for a crop of justice and righteousness, of mercy and love. The question is, what are you producing with what you've been given? God doesn't give a hoot about your net worth. God doesn't care how many square feet you live in, what make and model of car you drive. He doesn't care how high your position in your company is, how nice you dress, how you were elected to a certain position on this committee, or how you were put in the newspaper or on the radio, or all these positions or status. God is looking for justice and righteousness, for mercy and love. And that is a harvest that requires service from us and brings glory to him. That is our vineyard. And this morning, if you are struggling to eke out a meager living, and you want prayers of encouragement to bring in a true harvest for the Lord, to give him his due, to honor his servants, to worship his son, we want to pray for you, encourage you, lift you up. And if you are not yet a child of God and you want to become a follower of Jesus, it is time to turn your life over to him and move into that vineyard to serve the Lord, to have your sins washed away in baptism, be raised to walk in a new life in the Lord and live to serve him. If we can help you with anything this morning, won't you come as we stand and as we sing?